Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
Hi, I'm Gideon Long, and on Business Daily, we're looking at shipwrecks. We'll dive into the dispute over the Spanish galleon, the San Jose, which sank off the coast of Colombia 300 years ago with billions of dollars worth of booty on board. And we asked businessman Carl Allen why he became a shipwreck hunter. Join us on Business Daily from the BBC World Service every weekday to hear more about the daily drama of money and work. Search for Business Daily wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
And this is Andrew Peach on the BBC World Service. Welcome to World Business Report. Global oil prices are up sharply after President Biden appeared to hesitate when he was asked about possible strikes on Iranian oil facilities. We'll have more about the energy infrastructure in Iran, the possible consequences of all that in a moment. Sports betting has grown so big in Brazil, the government has now decided to regulate it. And
has it just become normal to feel poor in Australia?
A call for tax policies on Australia that help working people. Don't forget, we love it when you get in touch with us. The email address is world.business@bbc.co.uk. Let's start with the price of crude, up 5% today, seemingly because of this hesitation from President Biden.
We're in discussion with that. I think that would be a little... Anyway.
So it's a bit hard to hear, but asked at the White House if he would support Israel striking Iran's oil facilities, Joe Biden said, "We're discussing that," and then seemed to hesitate. The price of crude was soon above $77 a barrel. It's up 10% since Tuesday. More about that in a sec. But first, what energy infrastructure is there in Iran? What would the impact of strikes be? Let's talk to Naga Mortazavi, who's a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy in Washington and host of the Iran podcast. Naga, thank you very much indeed for being with us. Iran is the seventh biggest oil producer in the world. Well, talk us through what the infrastructure in that is.
Sure. So as you said, it's one of the largest producers of oil in the world. The oil is both exported, albeit under heavy U.S. sanctions. So Iran's exports and sales have been limited in recent years to smaller number of countries and smaller amount and also a lower price. But nevertheless, Iran is still a major exporter. And also, of course, there's domestic production for oil. It's still Iran's largest industry, although the economy has diversified in the past and is not solely reliant on oil as it was previously, but still it's at the core of the Iranian economy, and any attacks on the oil supply refineries infrastructure is going to have both domestic and global repercussions.
Mm. So I just want to outline what the infrastructure is. There's an export facility on Karg Island, and then there are refineries, as you say. So there are lots of different bits of the oil industry dotted about the country and off the coast.
Yes, most of the infrastructure is in the south, which is where the oil is actually extracted, in the province of Khuzestan in southwestern Iran. That's also the province that borders Iraq, and it's one of the areas that during the Iran-Iraq war in the 1980s, Saddam Hussein also attacked and used to go for the oil infrastructure a lot. And as you mentioned, there are also islands and these ports along the Persian Gulf in the south of the country. So sort of that southwestern corner of the country is the heart of the oil industry and the refineries and the export. And I think one of the options precisely is the Karg Island that has been a target in the past and could potentially be another target. So depending on how many targets and which targets are attacked, I think the repercussions on both domestic and global the oil environment is going to be different. And then another thing that we have to take into account is Iran threatening to broaden this if they see escalation. So they may not just take this as an attack on their own oil industry, but they may go around and attack other oil producers who are in the neighborhood. And that could also have repercussions for the global supply.
Lots to pick up on there. I just want to talk about Iran itself for a second or two. Obviously, oil export largely to China is a big part of the Iranian economy. What would the consequences be for people in Iran if the oil infrastructure or even the wider energy infrastructure was struck?
So, as you said, you're correct. Iran produces about 3 million barrels a day of oil. That's around 3% of the global output. And under heavy U.S. sanctions, economic sanctions that have targeted the oil industry, many countries and companies cannot do business with Iran, especially can't buy Iranian oil. But Chinese companies are one of the main ones that basically don't recognize these U.S. multilateral sanctions, and nevertheless, they still do business with Iran in different sectors, including oil, which means that they're risking sanctions from the U.S., but at the same time, they're buying this oil at a lower price. So Iran is essentially getting help from China to go around U.S. sanctions and still sell oil, though at a lower amount and a lower price. But this is going to have an impact on that supply chain, of course, for the export. And then, of course, on Iran's domestic oil and gas is just very heavily subsidized inside Iran. Iranians have access to it at a very low price, and it's part of, everyday life, just like anywhere else in the world. So it's going to affect household. It's going to affect transportation. In fact, Iran saw very heavy and deadly protests a few years ago as a result of the government hiking oil prices. So this could have domestic repercussions, both in the economy, but also sociopolitics of the country.
Yeah, because obviously it's nearly winter, right, in Iran. It's freezing cold in the winter in Iran. People are going to need to turn the heating on, that kind of stuff. We're not talking about people rolling in money for the most part in Iran. So, I mean, this has a sort of feel of what's happening in Ukraine about it, where Russia is specifically and has been for months targeting the energy infrastructure, which causes suffering for the the ordinary civilian population in the country. If it went down this road, it feels like that.
Exactly. And this is what we saw under the Iran-Iraq war. Actually, I lived through that war. I grew up through that war in Iran. And it also starts trickling down into other industries. It won't just impact oil industry. When oil prices go high, where the supply is lower than the demand, then everything else in the country gets impacted. Prices start to rise in almost every other commodity when it trickles down into the economy. And as you said, winter is coming. Winter is pretty harsh. In most of the country, it can get very cold. And Iranians rely on oil very much because it's an oil-producing country. It's very oil-heavy and rich. There aren't very many alternative or renewable other type of sources of energy. So the country very much does rely on oil. And a big part of the population also is dealing with economic hardships. And this would just add to it very much.
Let's bring in Megan Sutcliffe now, who's a Middle East Africa analyst with the London-based risk strategy firm Sibylline. Megan, thank you for being with us on World Business Report. Oil is still cheaper than it was earlier this year, so we don't blow this out of proportion, but going up 5% off the back of one sentence from Joe Biden, going up 10% since Tuesday this week, is still pretty big.
Absolutely. It certainly reflects the elevated anxieties that global oil markets are facing at the moment at the prospect of a major regional escalation.
And, I mean, in part we're seeing a flight to safety in so many ways. But just talk us through why the market is so jittery right now that an ill-considered, unscripted moment from the US president suddenly changes the price of a barrel of crude by 5% around the world.
Well, I think that the volatility that's been experienced following various comments from US President Joe Biden is really a reflection of just how tense things are in the Middle East at the moment. After Iran fired over 180 missiles towards Israel, of course, the question on everyone's lips has been, how is Israel going to respond? And the targeting of Israel's response, but also the intensity of its response, could have dire implications, not only for the stability of the region, but of course, therefore, could also have impacts on oil production and supply chains in what is arguably one of the most important producing regions in the world.
So if Iran stopped producing oil, or was stopped from producing oil, my understanding is that Saudi Arabia, the UAE could probably fill the gap in production. But what would that do to prices?
Well, I think it is, of course, possible that Saudi Arabia or the UAE or other OPEC members could fill that production hole. But OPEC's position on moderating the production cut that obviously has been in place for many months now remains relatively unclear. Indeed, OPEC refuted reports from the Wall Street Journal earlier today that they would be looking at potentially moderating the production cut. And so while it looks like we may be on track for some flexibility, particularly depending on where things stand in December, when OPEC would be looking to boost supplies in the global market, at present, what exact steps they would take remains unclear, particularly given the fact that if there was an Israeli strike on Iranian oil infrastructure, the impact of that strike would really depend on the scale of the strike itself and the damage that it did.
And of course, there'd be some kind of response from Tehran. And there's a lot of talk about Tehran choosing to block the Straits of Hormuz. And that's 20% of global oil production travelling through the Straits of Hormuz. So that could have a massive impact on the oil market.
Absolutely. And that shows why oil markets are so dependent on the geopolitical tensions in the Middle East that are so elevated at the moment. I think, though, that if we were to see an Israeli strike on oil facilities, Iran is unlikely to immediately close the Strait of Hormuz. That wouldn't necessarily be in their interest. But rather, if we were seen to be edging closer and closer to a regional war, if we were to see Israel engage in a significant escalation, for example, attempting to strike nuclear facilities within Iran, then that form of policy could become more feasible for Iran and would potentially become more strategic in their view. It's at that point in time that we'd be looking at major restrictions to supply to global markets and therefore huge implications for price.
And just final word on this. In amongst all of this, Libya is starting up oil production again, just as prices spike. Now, they're not in the same league of size of oil producer as the other countries we've been talking about, but just talk me through that.
Absolutely. So after about a month of a political crisis in Libya, we've seen authorities announcing that they have been given the word to resume production in certain locations. This in itself will moderately increase supply potentially, but I think there's two things that are worth noting here. Firstly, in the past few weeks, Libyan authorities have not exactly been transparent about how much has been produced out of these fields, which are open and which are not. And so the absolute amount of the increase in supply remains relatively unclear at present. But even if we did know exactly how much oil was going to be produced from these locations, Libya in the past decade has shown itself to routinely experience these cycles of instability when it comes to production and export. And so it is a relatively unreliable producer, particularly when we're in a period of elevated tensions. And markets are knowledgeable about that. And so this is unlikely to be the sigh of relief supply-wise that markets may be looking for, given the tensions in the Middle East as a whole that we're looking at the moment.
Megan Sukdev, thank you. Thanks also to Nega Mortazavi. Let's bring in our next guest, Kerry Leahy now from Columbia University. Just give me your take on the discussion we've been having about what's going on with oil prices and the incredible volatility there is at the moment.
It's very impressive, but we do remember that probably for most people, the major signal is going to be the actual price of oil. And I don't think it'll have a major deterrent on U.S. growth unless oil prices get to at least 90, more likely 100 plus, and have it sustained there. Then you could have some serious impacts for about every 10% increase in a barrel of oil, it increases the inflation rate by about a tenth. So if you had a $25 barrel of oil increase, you might be looking at another 2 or 3 tenths on the inflation rate. It certainly wouldn't make the Federal Reserve happy.
Okay, a couple of other stories I want to just talk through with you. Inflation in Turkey is down. Now, to put it in context, it's down to 50%, but that's the lowest it's been for quite a long time.
Well, not only does Turkey have a major inflation problem being fought finally by higher interest rates, and it's come down quite a bit, but this is also an economy that's run by a ruler who doesn't believe in the traditional laws of economics, and he thinks that lower rates will lead to lower inflation. When you have that with a central bank that's less than independent, you've got a lot of problems. But so I think it's getting better, but it's going to take a long way to work itself out, and you probably need the president to talk a new tune about the inflation interest rate relationship.
Okay. And we've talked all week on the program about the electric vehicle market. There was good news for Tesla yesterday, despite all the competition from China. But today, the Japanese manufacturer Toyota has decided to push back the start date for its electric vehicle manufacturing in the US because they don't think demand is strong enough.
Oh, it's very true. I think Toyota's patting itself on the back that it never got on the full EV train and talked about hybrids, and the consumer in America has responded in the same way. And the only area that where sales are actually up over the year are in hybrids. So the fact that they're cutting back and even setting up a major factory is another sign that there's a lot of consumers telling a lot of manufacturers like Toyota they really don't like EVs until we get a much better infrastructure to service and take care of those EVs, given the nervousness about driving them more than like 200 miles.
Kerry, thank you. Kerry Leahy from Columbia University. This is World Business Report from the BBC World Service.
Hi, I'm Gideon Long, and on Business Daily, we're looking at shipwrecks. We'll dive into the dispute over the Spanish galleon, the San Jose, which sank off the coast of Colombia 300 years ago with billions of dollars worth of booty on board. And we asked businessman Carl Allen why he became a shipwreck hunter. Join us on Business Daily from the BBC World Service every weekday to hear more about the daily drama of money and work. Search for Business Daily wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Poor Australians are bearing the brunt of increasing prices for everyday goods and often don't have any savings because of wealth inequality and tax policies that favour the rich. These are the conclusions of Anglicare Australia's Widening the Gap report. The charity is calling for investment incomes to be taxed fairly to prevent people earning money from work being taxed more than those who benefit from property and savings. From Sydney, our correspondent Phil Mercer reports.
Has it just become normal to feel poor in Australia?
Complaints about the cost of living echo loudly here. A leading charity believes the burden shouldered by those on low incomes is immense. It blames wealth inequality on investment policies that give generous tax benefits to property owners and those paying into superannuation or retirement funds.
It's not good for social cohesion to have this kind of wealth disparity. Casey Chambers, Executive Director, Anglicare Australia. What we could see is that the tax concessions for investment properties and the tax concessions for people paying more into their superannuation than the average worker puts in were really, really, really fueling this wealth disparity.
Anglicare Australia says that average rents for housing now take up more than 40% of wages, compared to only 20% 2 decades ago.
People are losing their homes. We see children who are doing their homework in cars and who are leaving to go to school from car parks. That's just not acceptable in any way for a country that can afford to do so much differently.
More than 120,000 people are estimated to be homeless in Australia on any given night. Among them are Sarah and her daughter.
We come for a feed. We're homeless at the moment. And we also come for a shower. We were working before we come down here and we were getting bullied through the work we were doing. So we just packed up our car and come to Sydney. Yeah, for a better life. Yeah, and to start again.
And just tell us a bit about being homeless. Does that mean you're sleeping in the car, you're sleeping rough or with friends or what?
No, we're sleeping in our car. Yeah, yeah. It can be rough at times.
The Uniting Church in the Sydney suburb of Ashfield is a beacon for the disadvantaged. It has a free restaurant and other medical and support services for those who are struggling.
What does your predicament say about Australia? People in other countries would think that Australia is a wealthy country where people don't sleep in their cars. What is the reality like?
Well, they do, and there's a lot of people out there that are homeless, whether it be in Australia or any other country. So it's no different from any other country. We're going through the same sort of thing.
Oliver.
And how difficult is the cost of living for you?
Oliver.
It's pretty hard when you have to live on a certain amount of money. Yeah. You've got to make do with what you have.
Tonight, as the housing crisis continues, there's speculation the Labor Party may again make negative gearing an election issue.
It would be a brave government to change or water down negative gearing, those tax breaks for property investors, which have been around for decades. In a testy exchange on Australian radio, the Prime Minister Anthony Albanese wasn't giving much away.
Are those tax policies completely off the table for you?
I don't answer those sort of questions in the way that...
You mean good ones?
Yeah, well, they're not terribly clever questions.
Charities say the richest Australians hold 90 times the wealth of low-income earners. The Reverend Bill Cruse at the Uniting Church says the gap is getting wider.
What we've noticed is that people who have money now can make money, but people who work can't. The rich are getting richer.
To what extent do you think Australia is perhaps losing or never even deserved that reputation for equality and a fair go?
It's gone. There's no talk about losing it anymore. It's gone. Just gone.
The government says cutting income tax and boosting employment are its main weapons to tackle inequality. But charities say far bolder reforms are needed to stop more Australians falling even further behind.
Our Australia correspondent Phil Mercer reporting. Now, I don't know whether you spent any time in Brazil. If you have, you are probably bombarded by adverts for sports betting. In Brazil, it's only been legal since 2018, but until now has been completely unregulated. Brazil now has more gambling websites than any other country on earth, and nearly every football team has an online casino or sports book as its sponsor. So now the government wants to bring in some regulation to try and gain control over the country's gambling habits. We'll talk about it with Fernanda Soares, who's a partner at AK Law, specialising in sport, and live with us from Brazil. Fernanda, thank you for joining us on World Business Report. Just explain how we've seen this explosion of gambling in the last few years in Brazil.
Hello, Andrew. How do you do?
Hi.
It's a pleasure to be here with you. The regulation, as you said, the regulation of sports betting in Brazil began to take shape in 2018 with this law which legalized sport betting, both for in-person and online events. And this law was significant in terms of, it was a milestone. It allowed companies to work in the Brazilian market which from then on experienced this massive growth. But this 2018 law, it established that the federal government should regulate the detailed functioning of the sector within a maximum of 4 years, which didn't happen. Now, the reasons for that were many, which I don't think we have time to go over here. But the
impact has been this, like, an explosion in sports betting, which to an extent we've seen everywhere, but in Brazil, unlike anywhere else, it's almost like taken over life.
Exactly. This market is huge. People have really bought into this Brazilian market. But as I was saying, I mean, we had this 2018 law which legalized the bettings. But then we had this vacuum of legislation, of regularization up until now, up until the end of 2023, which we had a new law, which detailed, would have more detailed regulation and established real clearer rules for the sector, which was not, which is something that was not fully addressed in 2018. So, and then with this new law at the end of 2023, the Minister of Finance had published 11 ordinances establishing detailed regulations. So we had this huge market. We're talking about, it's hard to estimate precisely, given that this is not yet a regularized market.
What sort of problems is it causing, Fernando? Because the government's obviously trying to respond to some social problems caused by this explosion in betting. What kind of thing is it trying to cure with the regulation it's bringing in now?
Well, we have many problems in a in a not regular market, right? We have companies that make publicization about bettings, giving the idea that you can actually get rich on bettings, or making propaganda directly for children and teenagers. So there are many, and then, you know, the bettors, the people who bet, they do not have the support, the legal support necessary if anything goes wrong, if they don't get their money. So because these companies are not based physically in Brazil, so it's hard to reach them legally. So we have many, many problems on a market like that. And what the government's trying to do now is set up some rules so that it can address these issues, you know, more issues than I told you.
But one consequence will be that in reining gambling in, it also then reins in the economic success of the sector, doesn't it?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
If the regulation works in cutting the amount of gambling going on, it also then cuts the growth, the benefit to the economy that's bringing.
It's not only about cutting the amount of gambling. It's gambling in a regular market. It's gambling with a market in which you can have, which the companies actually follow rules for the operation. You know, you have licenses, you have tax payments, compliance rules, consumer protection measures. You have obligation for operators to implement mechanisms to prevent fraud and combat match fixing, which as a sport lawyer myself, it's something that I'm very happy to see. We would have strict rules regarding advertising from betting houses, as I said. So, and we're also advertising that, you know, conveys the idea that it's possible to get rich through sports betting would be also something outside the law. And as you said, I mean, this is a very important point, because with the increase of betting in the betting market in Brazil, it had also bought with it a serious social consequence, which is the rising of cases of pathological gambling, with many people going into debt and spending a significant portion of their family income on that.
And there we have to leave it, Fernando. I do apologise, but thank you so much for your wisdom on that. That's Fernando Soares with us. Just as we come up to the end of World Business Report, lots of explosions in Beirut tonight, including ones near the airport in the last few minutes. Stay tuned for more on that here on the BBC World Service.
Hi, I'm Gideon Long, and on Business Daily, we're looking at shipwrecks. We'll dive into the dispute over the Spanish galleon, the San Jose, which sank off the coast of Colombia 300 years ago with billions of dollars worth of booty on board. And we asked businessman Carl Allen why he became a shipwreck hunter. Join us on Business Daily from the BBC World Service every weekday to hear more about the daily drama of money and work. Search for Business Daily wherever you get your BBC podcasts.